The following episode may contain explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
Today's episode is brought to you by the Atlanta Vision Institute. The Atlanta Vision Institute was the first in Georgia to use SMILE, the most advanced laser eye surgery procedure. This procedure is done with a high-tech precision laser. It's simple, takes about 6 to 8 minutes in its entirety. It's an easy recovery, requiring minimal post-op care. Most people are amazed at how effortless it is. You're going to experience substantially improved vision just a few hours after this surgery. Dr. Ashraf was on staff at Johns Hopkins University. He's board certified, and he's completed over 40,000 LASIK procedures. So go check out the Atlanta Vision Institute. Check this out. You can mention my name and get 20% off a consultation. To learn more, go to atlanta2020.com/Matt. That's me, M-A-T-T. atlanta2020.com/Matt. Go check out the Atlanta Vision Institute at atlanta2020.com. Welcome back to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Matt B. Davis. To distinguish the Atlanta Podcast with Matt B. Davis, if you're voting, have I sent you the link yet? I've been sending a lot of people that link to please vote for me. It would mean the world if I win Creative Loafing's Best of Atlanta Podcast. Link in the show notes. Also, September 20th, the first live event ever for the Atlanta Podcast. How exciting is that? We've got David Perdue, who's hilarious. We've got Trey Humphreys, who just did this amazing 30-day freaking challenge thing, and I want to ask him how that went. You can write me on all platforms at Matt B. Davis if you want to make a guest suggestion. And ATL Podcast on Instagram is where you can find a lot of great stuff. On today's program, Grant Henry, a.k.a. Sister Louisa. Many of you listening to this program have been to church. It's a bar. Bar, it's a church. The Ping Pong Emporium. I'm not saying the name right. Who cares? Right there in Edgewood. It's a landmark location. Who is the man behind it? What did he do before? What's he doing now? He had me in his home. It was lovely. And we connected in a real way. He's a very cool cat. Let's dive in. Away we go.
Okay.
I'm guessing you've done a few of these.
I've done a few of these.
I like your shades.
Oh, thank you. A friend of mine gave me these 100 years ago. They were too big for his head, and I've got a pretty big head. So.
And their prescription?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is probably my third, fourth prescription, and I've had them maybe 10, 15 years.
The frames?
Uh-huh.
How do you keep... Would you believe I just lost... So these...
Uh-huh.
These are Warby Parker. You know that company?
Yeah,
You order them through the interweb?
Yeah.
And... I travel a fair amount and lose everything and assumed I'd always lose it on the road, and I lost it at Target here in Edgewood.
Oh, wow. Well, I've heard good things about that company, but these are... He got them in, I think he said Hong Kong? No. He got them in London. It's this company called Cutler & Gross, but they must be like industrial strength because they don't break.
Are you rough with your glasses?
No.
Oh.
They stay on my head.
Well, I'm at the point now, honestly, where I only really need them to drive and watch television.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of constantly like doing this to look at my phone because
are your eyes going backwards or something?
Well, I'm too vain to get bifocals. /cheap. I know they cost more because now I can't see my phone if I'm wearing these.
Oh, I got you.
See what I'm saying? So I essentially just leave them off all day.
Well, these are bifocals that you can't see. So.
No, I think they make them that way now. But, you know, these by themselves, frames and all, are like $99. Whereas, you know, if you get the progressives, then you got to spend a little bit more. And
yeah.
I just haven't wanted to do that yet.
They help me see.
All right. So, where were you born? Let's always good to start there.
I hate to admit I was born in Panama City, Florida. Panama City. Do I need to watch my language on this?
No.
Okay. I was born in Panama City,
Florida. Well, Panama City, I guess it's not your fault to be born in Panama City. I mean.
Well, I was actually born in Panama City Beach, and it was in the 50s, so it was a much different place. It was mostly dirt roads, and there were lots on the beach with paper made for sale signs for like $50 down and $50 a month, but for a beachfront property.
It wasn't the
you know, teenage vacation hub that it became.
Oh, no. The only thing we had was Miracle Strip, and family friends owned that, and they own a hotel across the street, and that's pretty much all it was.
And then how long did you stay there?
We were in Panama City Beach for 5 years and moved to Panama City for 5 years. So my parents are both educators. So my dad was a principal in Panama City Beach, and my mother was a teacher in Panama City Beach, and she was my third grade teacher, actually.
Your mom was your third grade teacher?
Oh, I had to call her Mrs. Henry. It's fucked me up for life pretty much. Mrs. Henry.
You really, yeah. That had to be horrible.
Oh, it was horrible. Yeah, she was harder on me than anybody.
Of course she was.
She still is.
But she had to be. I mean, that's just kind of how that goes.
Yeah, she didn't want to be, you know, she didn't want people to think that she was giving me an easy time. So, yeah, I got shit. And I was a perfect kid. That's the issue.
You did not become the rebel that you later became in life. You were an easy kid.
Oh, I was an easy kid in life. I never went to the principal's office once my whole life. I just, you know, I was, voted most dependable in high school. It's just all kind of no. I was a perfect kid.
So
I was annual staff. And,
so where did this rebellious streak come from?
Am I rebelling? Do you see a rebellious streak?
Well, I mean, I've read some things.
Well, actually, I was, you know, sort of raised to be a good boy.
Okay.
And so I think I came to a point in my life that I realized that being authentic was probably a better calling than being a good boy.
Right.
So, you know, I just started, I think they had a lot of loss around, you know, along the way. That made me realize that, you know, sort of tomorrow written promise, and you sort of do it today, or do what you want to do today, or, you know, you're be dead.
Friends died, or?
Family members, car accidents, and stuff like that. And my divorce and my family, you know, parents, and it's just all of a sudden, it seems like there were a lot of rugs pulled out from under me, which not as a victim at all, because, I mean, I remember in middle school telling friends that, thank God my parents got a divorce, because I feel like I know things that, you know, this was back in the 60s or whatever. But thank God my parents got a divorce, because I now know how to negotiate life. So my rebellion, if you see rebellion, it really isn't. I mean, I'm the squarest guy you would probably ever know.
Really?
Like, I've never done drugs. I'm not a big drinker at all. I mean, I'll social drink, but I don't really. You wouldn't say I'm a drinker. I don't, you know. But I've never, you know, I had a brother that was pretty rebellious, and I never wanted to be like him. And he like did horrible in school. Every time I went to a grade, you know, who's 2 years older than I was, so every time I went to the next grade or whatever, they go, oh, you're Craig Henry's brother.
Right.
So I just was sort of the antithesis of that. So, you know, I'm pretty much the squarest guy, you know. I mean, I do what I want to do, and I love humor, and I love playing with symbols of what people believe, so it might be perceived as rebellious, but it's not. I mean, you know, I have a church on the corner of Edgewood and Boulevard that's across from a church, and, you know, it pretty much is a church. You know, not that kind of church, but it's, you know, it's a place where people go to do what they would probably intend to or hope to do at the Catholic church across the street,
which is
community, you know.
Community.
Yeah, it's just community.
Well, we'll get to church.
Okay.
And many other exciting things.
Okay.
So I don't know a ton about you, but that's kind of how I like to go in it sometimes, right? Did something jump on you? Did something bite you?
No, I've been working outside, and I had a tick yesterday, and I thought I felt something on my arm.
But that's kind of how I like to do it, is that if I have genuine curiosity about you, then my listeners will get that rather than, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So, but let's back up a little bit. So when did you get to Georgia? Or what did you want to be when you were being the squarest kid there was in high school? What did you think was next for you?
Well, I worked at a children's camp, like a YMCA camp, for like 10 years. From when I was 11, I started being a counselor until I was 21. So my first degree that I started out was in recreation. I just thought, well, I like this, I'll do this, you know. And then I started doing that a little bit, and then I you know, realize that probably, you know, don't want to be a camp counselor for life, probably not. And so,
sort of
it's fun. I like jumping in the water.
Right. Sort of a young person's job.
Yeah. So I was like a WSI, and I taught archery. And I did things that, you know, at the camp, and I became the program, you know, the head men's program director at the camp. And I don't really do a lot of planning in life. You know, sort of life sort of happens. And I look back and see it's threaded from the beginning to the end. So I did that, and then I did change my degree to hotel, restaurant, and travel because I thought that was sort of tourism. It's sort of a bigger picture, sort of a business into it than just a degree in recreation,
right?
Which would, you know, you'd probably, you know, get out of college and make $8,000 a year for life or whatever. So I ended up changing my degree to tourism. So I jumped around. I'm flighty. Like a butterfly.
And what years is this that you're in college? I'm trying to get a sense of the world.
100, okay. So 2018 minus 100. No, I graduated from high school in 1974.
Okay.
I graduated from college in 1978.
Okay.
I went to three colleges.
Which schools?
So I started off at Berry College for 1 year, which was an hour away from where we lived here in Georgia at the time.
Okay.
And then I fell in love with this girl and transferred to FSU.
Florida State?
After the first year. And then a bunch of us were in the hotel restaurant school down at FSU, and they opened up a new hotel tourism school in Miami at Florida International University.
Okay.
So a bunch of us moved from Tallahassee to Miami. So I finished there. I was there the last 2 years, my junior and senior year.
Right.
And got a degree in hotel, restaurant, and travel.
And your first job out of school was?
I was a paid spy. I would go around to hotels and restaurants and check in and eat and spend the night there and do everything, swim in their pool, you know, go to their restaurants, go to their, whatever they had. And then the next day at 10 o'clock, I'd knock on the manager's door and say, hey, I'm Grant Henry with Quality Assurance or whatever. Then I would spend the day or a few hours with the manager.
Talking about maybe what was, but who sent you?
Well, when I was in college, I worked for a year for Marriott and then a year for Sheraton. And then when I graduated from college, I didn't really graduate from college. I sort of left.
You were in-house. You weren't from some organization sent there.
No.
You were like hired by Sheraton to go check on the other Sheratons.
My first job out of college was Days Inns of America, which was based out of Atlanta, Georgia. It was a Baptist preacher that owned Days Inns of America, Cecil Day.
Okay.
So that was my first job. I wanted to get back to Georgia because, I don't know, I just felt like it was home or whatever.
Right.
So it was Days Inns of America would send me around. So I would quarterly go to a different quarter of the United States so that they wouldn't know who you are. So there were four of us in quality assurance, and we would rotate every...
Right.
And then they would figure out who we are and then, you know, pay us off.
Did they... Are you being serious?
Oh, yeah. I may have been proposed sexually.
That's awesome. Guys and girls?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I mean, once they knew who you are... The
statute of limitation is now up. Can you admit to anything? Because I don't judge.
No. What do you mean, admit to what?
Well, I mean, if you took a bribe.
Oh, I never did.
Never did.
Oh, I'm fucking square. No, I'm not that guy. I just had never done that. I mean...
Were you tempted?
No. No. I mean, I'm not real smart that way. I mean, I'm even in business, you know. Everybody says, well, I guess who'd you pay off to get that blah, 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 to be able to do that? And, you know, it's sort of tempting to think about it, but my problem is I have kids. And I have grandkids, and I don't want to, I never did, you know, in the 70s, cocaine was this big thing, but some basketball player, died from cocaine. I forget what his name was.
Lynn Bias. Early 80s, he died, yeah.
And that was right about the time when people were whatever. I was married by then or whatever, but that scared the shit out of me, you know, because I don't want my daughter to read in the paper that her dad.
How many kids you have?
I have two stepkids and one birth kid. When I was 21, 22, I married a wonderful woman with two children that were 7 and 9, I think, 6 and 8, and then we had our own a few years later.
And they're grown now.
Oh yeah, but stepson is an attorney here in town, doing great, and my stepdaughter got her PhD at Emory in sociology, so she does that and lives in Decatur, and then my daughter helps with church, and my daughter's 36 now. So,
well, can we talk offline? Because my kids are still young, and it's pretty miserable in my house.
How old are they?
They're 11, 9, and about to turn 5.
Okay. Yeah. Well, everything's phasing. Nothing lasts. So that's my biggest advice.
You know what somebody said the other day? Because we struggle with some of our kids, and this guy said, my wife's at her job, and something was taking a minute, and she said, hey, I don't, you know, thanks for being patient or whatever. And he said, all I have is patience. She said, what do you mean? He said, well, otherwise I'm miserable. And I was like, that's some heavy shit, man.
Yeah. 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 Well, if you, you know, everybody wants to be authentic, even your kids. Your kids want to. So the problem, I think, is parents. We try to get into a power struggle and form them into who, how they need to behave or who they become. And so that's the struggle until they get out at 18 or 20 or whenever they go somewhere. So if you don't, you're the adult. So if you don't participate in the power struggle and let them be, they'll be great people. But if you, if they feel like you're wanting them to be something else, they're going to be something else.
I think we're both pretty good at letting them be who they are. Uh-huh. It's about how much peace do we want in the house. That's the part where we get crazy, right?
Well, have you ever seen those little rubber earplugs that you can get? Just put earplugs in them.
Well, the answer, we think one of the answers is a house with multiple levels. Right now we're on one floor. So if they're down in the basement or up in the whatever,
exactly,
then they can destroy whatever. But on the same level, it's
exactly.
It's
my
tough.
Daughter just went from a 1,300 square foot home last year, for a 1,300 square foot home, to a 3,000 square foot home, and with from three bedrooms to five bedrooms, and one of them's a playroom. Her life is completely different as it was a year
right.
ago. So I say, yeah, buy a bigger house.
I think that might be I got to make some more money.
Yeah,
and then
how much are you charging me for this podcast?
This is absolutely free.
All right.
Okay, so
you can get some free sangria at church if you want.
I'm not a drinker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I'm one of those people that had to cash in all my chips.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
Oh, okay. I'm not that kind of not drinker. I mean, I enjoy drinking when I do drink, but it's mostly just a time with a friend for me. It's not that.
Well, I mean, we're going to bounce all over the place here, but sometimes folks in the bar business, that's why they're in the bar business. They want a party, and then they die or get robbed or stuff. Yeah. Bad stuff happens because they want to live that life. But you're not that guy.
I'm not that guy. I got a job, my first job at the local on Ponce de Leon over there. And I'd never been to a bar. I was, 40, 45? I'd never been to a bar and sat down and said, oh, what you got on tap? That's not me. I just didn't know. When I started bartending there, because a friend of mine owned it, and who owns Eats, and I told him I went to learn to bartend because I had a bar at my home, and this was another place, and he said, oh, I'll go down there and, you know, I'll tell Danny to train you to bartend. So he trained me on Mondays between 4 and 7 so I could do no damage, because I didn't know the difference. I didn't know what was in a vodka tonic. I didn't know it was in a rum and coke or whatever. So, I mean, seriously, I didn't. I'd never done it. And so I went down there and I learned to bartend. And maybe a few months later, after I'd been training on Monday from 4 to 7 in the afternoon, he said, you know, one of their main bartenders left and said, do you want the job? And I said, oh, no. I just did this to learn. He said, well, you do it till I find somebody. So I was there 10 years.
Wow.
And I did my art, and it was easy, because it was great, because I did it maybe three nights a week, and I was free four nights a week, and I was free 7 days a week. So that's how I learned the bar business. I didn't know. That's why I'm talking about my life works backwards. It doesn't work forward, because I didn't plan to be a bar owner. But here I am.
And what was your art, quote unquote?
Sister Louisa art.
But what you got to explain to people what that is.
Oh, my art. Well, this gets into the rebellious part, I guess, because after my bachelor's, I got a master's in education, middle childhood education, because I had married these kids, and I sort of wanted to know what they were about to go through in their middle school years. So I did that, and then my wife and I were married 9 years, and I just sort of was trying to figure out who I was and whatever, and ended up going to seminary, Presbyterian Seminary in Decatur, Georgia, Columbia Seminary. And so I went there and, you know, sort of went through the program, did some, most of the time there, went up to Princeton to do some courses up there. And then at the end of it, they wanted me to be ordained or whatever. And to go through ordination, you had to say something that I couldn't say.
Which is?
They wanted me to stand up in front of the whole congregation and say, or in the whole Presbyterian church, and say, only through Jesus Christ is salvation possible. And I said, I really can't say that. He said, what do you mean? Well, there are other people all over the world that never heard the word Jesus Christ, and I think it's just sort of something through the church. It's not real. I said, let me change it to, instead of only through Jesus Christ is salvation possible, let me change it to salvation is possible through Jesus, could be possible through Jesus Christ.
Right.
Because I knew, you know, you can see it from looking at butterflies, or you can, you know, I have an aha experience some other way without ever having known the word Jesus Christ. So, they, you know, I... After 3 years in seminary, I left.
I would think that's kind of attuned to like showing up at Coke and being like, why don't we say that like Pepsi's kind of okay?
Yeah, I wasn't really. I mean, it was like, you know, it's a, I guess Christianity is part of the picture, but I didn't feel like it was the big picture. And they wanted me to say that it was the only picture.
But what, something in you wanted, what is it in you that wanted to seek this other thing though? Like anybody that gets that sort of calling.
Yeah. I think it was just...
Because, by the way, I'm Jewish, not a big Jesus guy either.
Yeah,
and I experience God in 100 ways that have nothing to do with being Jewish either. So exactly. I feel you.
Well, to me, it was more of a search for truth because, you know, not in a bad kind of way, but I think just because I grew up wanting to... I grew up being a good boy. Being a good boy doesn't mean you're honest. Doesn't mean you're, you know, actively honest. It means you're good. So there might be things that you feel like you need to go and that you don't go because you're trying to please this other, you know. So I think it was more of a search for truth. And so it was, you know, it was an awesome experience. I don't regret it one bit. But when I started doing my artwork, like, 1996? Is that 22 years ago or 32 years ago?
I have no idea.
Shit. However long that ago is, I started collecting these paintings of Jesus and paint-by-number pictures. So, and I would say things about it. At the time, I had an antique shop. Long story, but it doesn't matter. I had an antique shop because I had all these, I had all these pictures up there that nobody would want to buy. Why would you go into an antique store? I had great antiques, but why would you have a paint-by-number of Jesus? Or,
well, because it's kind of kitschy and cool.
Yeah, it's sort of kitschy and cool. So I started collecting them all. So
did other people think it was kitschy and cool, or just you at this point?
They started thinking. They started buying them, but what I did was the Telephone Factory. At that time, the Telephone Factory was coming about over there on Ralph McGill, and it was, they filled the bottom floor with artists because, you know, it was a modern income place, so you had a certain percentage of the people that lived there had to make less than X amount of money. So instead of going after single mothers or whatever with 80 children, they went after artists and let artists live there. So it was a little bit controversial at the time. So we had art shows over there. So friends of mine lived there, and I felt like I was an artist, but I didn't know what my calling was. So I went probably middle of the night and grabbed a bunch of these Jesus paintings and went to Office Depot and got some oil paint markers. And the things I would used to say about it, like there'll be a picture of Jesus with curly hair, and I'd say he curls his hair with holy rollers.
Right.
Or whatever it was. I would say stupid things, and some people, you know, probably 80% of people would laugh and love it, and 20% would hate it.
So you don't, and so just to kind of touch on this, you don't see that as rebellious. You just see that as your sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really see that as rebellious at all. But, you know, or, and it, all of it's, I mean, all of it's true. I mean, if Jesus was half human, then he had a sense of humor. So for me, it's like, you know, I don't know. It's, you know, I don't know if that's reverent or irreverent, but if their story is that he's half human because something in the sky impregnated his mother, and so there was a mother that was a human being. So I don't look at that. I don't look at anything. No. And also, I mean, if you think about it, what they say in Christianity, and I'm not, hallelujah, if somebody's Christian, I mean, you know, I'm not. But if somebody comes along, you know, and they're Christian, they're going to find out in Christianity is there's nothing that you can do or say that would diminish God's love for you. If you really believe it, then you can do a painting that says nothing harder than a preacher's dick, you know? I mean, seriously, because it is what it is, you know? So there's nothing. Jesus loves gays. Well, you know, if Jesus says he loves everybody, then Jesus loves gays. So these paintings are pretty basic. I don't see it. There's too much of rebelliousness going into them. But so I took all these paintings and had an art show and sold out on the art show. And so I just started doing it. I thought, well, this is pretty cool. It's some extra money. You know?
And you called it Sister Louisa Art because you took on this other character, Sister Louisa?
No, some friends and I had gone to Amsterdam and met this woman named Louisa. And so got back, and the art show was about to happen, and I had started writing on the paintings, you know. And at the time, I just probably wasn't confident enough, so I didn't want it to say Grant Henry on the bottom of it, you know. So I thought, well, how's the best way to make it not be Grant Henry art? And I thought, well, I'm a guy, so let's make it a girl. So this sister happened, and we had just gotten back from Amsterdam, met this wonderful little spiritual bird named Louisa. She was an attorney over there, and I loved her. And so I thought, I'm just going to call it Sister Louisa. And so she just started, you know, 1996, I started doing Sister Louisa art. And since all of them sold, I had a ton of them up there, since all of them sold on the at that art show, I thought I'll just continue to do it. So I, you know, did art show. I think my first art show was maybe at Mary's, and then there was one at Octane over there on the west side. And it just started going from there. And
and did you think, wow, this is great, I think I have kind of backwardsly found my calling?
No. I still haven't found my calling. No, I don't, no. Hell no. But I felt like it was a good step toward being authentic because, you know, I left seminary. Since they told me, you know, when they said that I had to say only through Jesus Christ was salvation possible, what their story is, hey, listen, guy, listen. You know, you can't stop now. You've been here 3 years. You did great in preaching class. You're going to be a great preacher, you know, part of the Presbyterian Church. People in the church will let you use beach houses and mountain houses, and your kids will have education. And being a part of the Presbyterian Church, you'll have this and this and this and this. So basically it was, it was lifestyle over truth. And so that's where Sister Louisa Hart came. Because it's truth over anything else. And the truth of the matter is, there's been no negative, I've really had no negative effect from doing Sister Louisa art, other than people who maybe don't say anything to me. Rarely has there been, I had a little bit of backlash when I opened up a church in Atlanta, but, you know, it's the truth. You look at any of the Sister Louisa arts, and every one of them, the fine line is the truth. But it's celebrating symbols of what people believe, and they could be different beliefs. It's not so much what I believe. I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything. You know, it's just I'm just putting out there.
But do you understand that? Like, I'm starting to understand that for you, it's just this search for the truth and this expression of who you are. But that a lot of people that go down your road, it's much more of a sort of a punk fuck you thing. Because they have been lied to by their church or their parents or religion.
I'm 61 years old. I'm no punk. Fuck you.
I know, but you understand that a lot of times what it just comes natural to you. It's just this. It is what it is. But I'm saying the reason I was asking is without knowing you.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of that comes from for people that go down that road. It's like a big, like, well, fuck you and. You can't tell me that gays aren't cool and whatever.
Oh, no, no. They have no idea who I am. Anybody that says anything like that, they have no idea who I am.
But do you understand that that's how a lot of people wind up where you are? It's a lot angrier position.
They think I'm angry.
No, no, no. They are.
Oh, well, you know what? That's what I'm saying. It's the church. You go into the bar that's called church, and you have people. We've had like seminary classes do their classwork upstairs in the beginning, more when it was not as busy, you know. And so everybody's got to be where they are. But anything that anybody reads into Sister Louisa art is where they are in life. It's not where I am in life. So that's what I like about it. It's just like it makes people. You know, most bars you don't talk about church, you don't talk about religion or politics, you know, sexuality. There's just things you just are, you know, you don't talk about sometimes when you're in a bar. But in church, that's what you talk about. And I don't know that we've ever gotten in, I don't know that there's ever been a bar fight. Well, here's the thing. You're sitting there next to somebody and you're looking up at all this stuff. Well, the stuff on the wall is a lot more fucked up than you two are, so you're going to be friends. And I don't have TV. And I don't have smoking. So you're confronted with having to communicate with everybody that you meet inside church, because there's nothing else to do other than be bombarded by this absurd art, number one, and everybody else. So they're going to tell their story. Well, whoa, that makes me a little uncomfortable. You know, you're standing there.
Do you get hit up by the, or do they even have those anymore? Those little machines that they used to put at bars? the little trivia machines or whatever? Did you get hit up by those people?
No.
They just know, they're like, they know to stay clear.
Well, you know.
Although I'm guessing technology has moved on from those,
maybe. I'm not a bar guy, really. I'm just, you know, when I left the local after 10 years and decided to open up my own bar, the only example I had of a bar was the local. So when people came in, and we didn't have those games over there, but like when I started to open up, all the liquor reps says, well, we need to get together and we need to talk about what kind of alcohol you want to get, and we need to get together and figure out what kind of pricing you need to have. And I said, listen, no. I took a snapshot of the bar behind the, you know, the alcohol behind the local bar, and I said, this is the exactly here is what I'm doing. Because... And I'm pricing exactly as the local has it, because they have three owners and all three are rich. So I'm one owner, so I will be rich. I don't want to talk about it. So I never even, I mean, we still have prices that we have. You know, I mean, we're the cheapest on the Edgewood because, you know, I knew those prices. I wasn't going to go relearn, you know, okay, Jack at the local was this amount.
So did you, it's still a lot to go from bartender to bar owner. So did you take loans? Did you save a bunch of money?
I have no idea. I was going to do it with some partners in the beginning. One of the guys from the local and I were going to do it. And then there was a little difference about where it wanted to be. And a lot of the people at the local, the kids that went there, you know, I was in my 40s or 50s then. So but the kids that went there, they all said, and I loved them all and still do. But so they would say, you know, I wish there was a bar over there on Edgewood because we live over there and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I wish there was a bar on Edgewood. And Noni said opened up and Sound Tables was, you know, whatever. But that whole strip was like nothing. And a friend of mine owned a building on the corner of Edgewood and Boulevard that was a coffee shop. And it was called Danneman's Coffee. And they decided to let Danneman's Coffee go. So the only reason I went there is because it was somewhere that it was someone that could just say, hey, listen, here's a key. You know, you can build out church if you want and you pay rent. So I started renting that space over there. So it was sort of an easy transition. I had credit cards, so I would do stuff on credit cards. And I don't know how I opened it up. Tell you the truth, I have no idea how I opened it up. You know, I got to the end of the road about to open up, and I was short some money, and a friend loaned me some money. He said I'd give it back to him within a year, and then I gave it back to him like 3 months later. So
you did that well right away?
Oh, the day I opened up. So I'm a whore. I mean, I love sharing my life or whatever, and so I already had a Facebook page. Yeah, that's sort of sad for a 61-year-old to say. But I had a Facebook page that was Sister Louisa's Art Gallery in the Church of the Living Room. So that was over in the Telephone Factory. So I went to that Facebook page, Sister Louisa's Art Gallery, and I took out the words Art Gallery and just did Sister Louisa's Church of the Living Room in Ping Pong Emporium, Come On In Precious, because I had ping pong in my loft where the gallery was too. So every day I would show what I was building out. I would show this, I put this thing, I showed the artwork here, I showed the... You know, the bullhorns here. I showed Martin Luther King over the bar. So I did that for the months we were building it out. So that we had a friends and family on December 21st, maybe. And then that was going to be from maybe 5 to 9 p.m. for friends and family. And at 9 o'clock, when the friends and family was over, I said to my staff, I said, how are you doing? And they said, we're doing great. I said, would you rather continue tonight or you will start tomorrow night? And every one of them said, no, let's do this. So I turned around the computer at the bar and on Sister Louisa's Facebook page, and I wrote, don't tell anybody. but
we're open.
Church is officially open.
Right.
And we were slammed. We were slammed. So it was great, but I was bartending. So a lot of people I've known, I'm 100, so I've known a lot of people in life. So a lot of people came, I couldn't talk to them because I was going, we didn't have a POS system. We wrote down on paper. Like the orders would be on paper for the servers, you know. And so I'm sitting there making drinks, and then like best friends from all over life and whatever were coming out there in the first month of, you know, opening up or what. And I couldn't talk to them. So I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I thought, well, maybe I should, you know, get a bartender. And then I would go out and whatever. So I did that. So I bartended maybe a month. And And then after that, I just sort of hung out, and I was there every hour for the first couple of years. And, you know, it was great. It was awesome, but I didn't really mean to be. And the truth of the matter is, you know, don't let any business school hear this podcast, because the night that I opened up, I had $600 to my name in my life. $600. If I sort of had to put on there that we're open.
Right.
Because, you know, I needed money.
Right.
And I had worked for tips for 10 years at the local. So remember I told you I'm not real smart. I wasn't even sort of conscious that the credit card money that was going on this little machine would end up in my checking account. I just thought, okay, I need to make enough tips to live. Like,
right.
I've been doing it for 10 years.
Right.
And then all of a sudden the next morning you go, ooh.
Right.
That's mine.
We did okay.
That's mine. And I remember the first night of counting tips, and all the bartenders and servers were there, and we were all giddy or whatever. And all this money there was, and we had no systems in place yet. We just had no systems. And I just looked at them. I said, I have no idea whose fucking money this is. So we just sort of...
just divvied it out.
Just divvied it out. And so it was just learning. It was just trial and error.
But I do want to ask you, because this whole ping pong thing, it was a thing there for a minute, right? I think it's gone now, the ping pong thing.
Oh, no. Every Monday night we have ping pong tournament.
I know, but I'm saying like it was like...
it was a big deal. Well,
it was like the celebrities came down and played... So you were ahead of that curve is what I'm trying to say.
Well, no. Every Monday night we still have the ping pong tournament. But at the time I went, Stephen, that's when I met my friend King of Pops, because when we were opening up, this goofy kid kept calling up there every day, ping pong open yet? I said, no, we're not open yet. You know, it's not open yet. So finally on the opening night, or this guy comes up, I'm the guy that's been calling you about ping pong, want to play ping pong. So I'm good at ping pong. My father played ping pong. Great. I grew up playing ping pong.
See, now I'm really wishing we went there, because then I could play you.
No, I would kick your ass.
I know. And see, now I really want to play. I mean, I haven't picked up a paddle in years, but...
Oh, yeah. Anyway,
but so, by the way, I wouldn't have mattered. But you see, I like it. Like, if there's some background noise, unless somebody's, like, running a blender while we're talking, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, I loved ping pong, but all of a sudden, you know, I got a special paddle made, and I was playing every Monday night, and then for some reason, I just sort of stopped. I haven't really played ping pong in a few years.
But I'm saying, so your dad was a ping pong player, you're a ping pong player, and then you just happened to, you seem like your life, the way it goes, like, oh, ping pong is now a hot thing.
No. I remember going into this place, a recreation place over there on the west side, and right in the very beginning, and I said, I need to get another ping pong table. And because ours broke down, I said, oh, well, where are you? He goes, I own this bar called Sister Louise's Church of Liver and Ping Pong. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. They pull out a framed article from somewhere, Atlanta Magazine, I forget where the article was, about this ping pong bar opening up in Atlanta in 2010. And he said, you're the reason we are selling ping pong so much. And I didn't do it because it was popular at all. I did it because, truthfully, I already had a ping pong table and I love playing ping pong. And I didn't know, you've been to church, right?
I have not.
You have not been. Well, church is two floors.
Right, I'm aware of that.
The top floor is ping pong table.
Right.
And
I've seen the photos. So, I've known people who go there.
Well, the and you live so far away from it, is it, and you're not a drinker.
Well, the funny thing
and
is
you're Jewish.
Well, the funny thing is I actually drove by it almost every morning, because my office used to be right here in the it's called Alkaloid. It's right there across from Rathbun's, next to Ladybird.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I literally drive by you every day. And interestingly enough, doesn't really matter. We can talk about it later. Yeah. There was a message that your merch person was looking for a website developer, and I tried to refer to that person, but that didn't happen either.
Oh, yeah.
Probably, do you even know about that? Do you even know it?
Probably not.
You opened a thing called Church Merch. Are you aware of that?
Yeah.
It's across the street.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it's the first floor of 489. It's a great location. We just sell hats and T-shirts and stuff like that. I bought that building with a friend who does. He's an architect upstairs.
Right.
He does the upstairs part of it. But, so, no, I did not open church because I thought it was a, or I didn't open up the ping pong part of it because I thought it was popular.
No, I'm saying you were, had a ping pong. I know, I'm saying you were ahead of that curve. That's what
yeah.
I was saying.
Yeah.
Because every, so I moved to Georgia in, moved back to Georgia in like 07, 08. And that's why I had an office in Little Five, I think around 2010, 2011. And I remember there was always either an article or a something that like, oh, so-and-so see you're shooting a movie. And they went to,
yeah,
they went to church.
Yeah, we were lucky that way. I think what it is, it's so fucked up. And it's not by design. It's just because it is fucked up. And people, I thought it was normal, the Sister Louisa stuff, you know. And I had it was as much art as is in church now, in Telephone Factory. And I said, fuck this shit. I hate Sister Louisa, you know. And so I threw all Sister Louisa in the dumpster at the Telephone Factory, and I moved to Mexico. I was going to go for a year. So I went, I was gone in the year 2000, most of it to Isla Mujeres, Mexico. And when I came back, I just hadn't, it was becoming part of my identity or whatever, and I just like, you know, whatever. So I threw it all in the dumpster. When I came back, a friend of mine who had an iron shop or steel shop over there in the Telephone Factory behind it, he says, come here, I want to show you something when I got back. And I said, what's up? And he goes, I pulled all your art out of the dumpster, and I got it up here.
Wow.
And so, you know, the bitch is back. I thought, shit, that's what, you know, I sort of let go. So I did that, and I started a gallery, and because I had a perfect spot in the Telephone Factory. And
did you and Steven correspond over Mexico?
No. I didn't meet Steven until 2010.
But you guys later bond because he had his crazy.
Yeah, he's been to Isla Mujeres, and he and Nick have gone there. And my daughter lived there for a long. She was in Mexico for 13 years or whatever. So we have an affinity for, you know, Mexico or, you know, Carmel or whatever. So Steven and I didn't meet until after we got, you know, after the meeting.
Right. So then the last, I mean, it's interesting because the same way that, like, I said to Steven, if you go back and listen to the interview, that, you know, when he said it's only been around since 2010, I thought, wow, and you're like such a fabric of Atlanta kind of thing, uh-huh. King of Pops is.
Yeah.
It's not like 30 years or even 20 years. And I think church is kind of similar because we've watched that neighborhood grow up around it, yeah. Essentially.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, when I
built, I mean, every time I come down one of these streets, there's a whole fucking building going up.
Yeah. When I first opened it up, and every bar, like, they were great. But at the time, everybody wanted this light wood bar, you know, like white-looking wood, stained, no clear, you know. So all the bars were doing that kind of stuff. And so when I was building out the church, I used this fir because, Fraser fir, because it was like the best wood. So the builder that was helping me, or contractor was helping me build it out and everything, got to the end of it, and it was all that wood is new back there. And I said, okay, now I just want to sort of hammer it and dent it a little bit, and then I'm going to paint it, and then I'm going to put this mud-looking stain over it. So I want it to look really old when I open up. So when I opened up, it looked like it'd been there forever.
Right.
And I'm a decorator. But that's all I really want to do in life. So I just, you know, it was a great opportunity to decorate it. And when I first opened up, it wasn't even, I mean, I didn't really have anything else to do. I had just the decor. I had no choice but to put all that shit up on the wall. Because I don't know what else I would do. You know, and I like to open up. I like to do things that just like are a vignette, you know. So church is a vignette. My home is different. This isn't look like church. Church on the inside is, you know, there's a million things that distract your eye, and they're tacky, and they're not couth and
right
whatever, and my home is completely different than that.
Because you want a different vibe when you come home.
Yeah.
You want to relax.
Yeah. And although, you know, opened up one in Athens a few years later, I think it's been there 4 years now, but that's sort of similar, but they're a little bit different name.
What's it called?
Sister Louisa's Church. It's a glory hole.
So it's called the same thing, Athens version.
Yeah, so this is Sister Louisa's Church at the Living Room Ping Pong Forum in Athens. It's smaller and it's darker, so I called it the glory hole. And it's been, it's huge. They do percentage-wise, as far as amount of people in Atlanta and Athens, it does better than Atlanta, and Atlanta does great.
But in a college town, isn't it more, I don't know, isn't it harder to stay? Sort of, don't they, like, well, they all open and close? And
it reminds me, the reason they do is what you first started this conversation on. Most people, I wouldn't say most, I would say in Athens more than Atlanta, people who go to school there and they go to college there, their buddies drink. So they'll say, hey, this bar is for sale for $40,000. You got $10,000? You got $10,000? You got $10,000? You got $10,000? So they open up the bar, but the reason they do it because they want to continue to drink.
Right.
But I do think, I do know for me, and I when I drink, if I'm sitting at the bar drinking and I have friends come in, nobody pays.
Right.
I'll just say, my tab.
Right.
On my tab.
Right.
Put this on my tab. And so if I were there every day drinking, and that's what happens at a lot of bars.
And that's
so
how they run out of money.
So they'll go to
business. Well, for a guy who didn't want to hear about pricing and didn't want to change anything, to stay successful and open, you got to have, like, you got to have operations people, right? And people that look at the money. And did you just, like, hire those people as they came on? Or you figured it out?
Oh, no. I have the greatest people. We don't... most of our employees stay. So when I first opened up, I found great people. I mean, just great people were great. You know, people that gravitated to the concept or that I found from wherever, they've been super loyal. And I'm not a micromanager. So.
Well, that's what I mean. You just like trust them to figure it out.
Well, sort of. Okay, here's me. Here's me up here. So there's church here in Atlanta. There's church in Athens. There's church merch. And then I'm opening up a place called Sanctuary right now in Griffin. And it's here. So I'm here. And then there's these things. So each one of these places have somebody that basically runs it. And they sort of, my daughter, I'm not, I can't fill out paperwork. I'm not that guy. I can't fill out paperwork. I can't apply for mortgages. I can't apply for license. I hate that stuff. I hate to go to the city and all that. But my daughter is sort of as neurotic and, focused as I am, but not on decor or not on marketing kind of stuff. So she's brilliant. She was a real estate broker in Mexico. So she can do all that. So she moved from Mexico with her family. So they live here now. So all these managers here... And Mary Grace, they deal with anything that has to be. She doesn't work in the places, but each one of these places, like Athens doesn't pay their own bills, Merch doesn't pay their own bills, Church doesn't pay their own bills, Sanctuary doesn't pay their own bills. Mary Grace pays all. So she sets every, internet account, every gas, electricity.
I think you've described my future solution.
What?
Because I'm like you, I hate all that shit.
Don't do it.
I'm not going to, but I got to wait because my daughter's only 11.
Well, the family is good because Mary Grace is not going to steal, number one.
Right.
And everybody loves her. She's got a great personality. And and I think everybody by this point, I can say it, is everybody knows that I'm not real smart. So they know that and I'm not a micromanager. So, like, bartenders... I don't know who's working.
Right.
They schedule themselves. But you know what? 7 years, we're almost 8 years now, not once has someone called and said,
get out.
Ask everybody. I just said it to the world. No one's ever called in sick. But I didn't set it up that way because I didn't want a phone. I said, I don't want get a phone call for me. So there's 8 bartenders. If you're sick, you find your replacement. You don't tell me about it. I don't even want to know about it. I don't care if you work or not. But you have to find your replacement. So the kitchen is the same way. The door was the same way. So
why don't more people operate like that? Most
people are micromanagers. They want to go in and they want to think everybody's stealing from them. And I know, because I'm smart enough and I can read the internet and I was at the local for 10 years, I know what percentages of alcohol costs are supposed to be to your total income and everything. So I keep an eye on it and I look at my checking account every day. So I know that I know what's happening, and I know about, numbers of bottles that are ordered, and I know we have – so each one of the POSs now, we got POSs finally. So each one of the POSs sends me a nightly report. So I can tell we had, 120 PBR cans. We had, 200 glasses of sangria. I know what's being sold, but I don't have to be there to know it. And also all the places have cameras. So, I can be in Texas, I can be in England, and I can look at my cameras and see. And also, in 8 years, we've never, and this sounds like I'm bragging, but it's just, I'm bragging on my staff. Not once have we opened up after 5 o'clock, and not once have we closed before 3 p.m. because it's just like, you know, in this age of the internet and the age of texting and age of, you know, these getting groups together. And if you ever once told a bunch of people to meet you at church and they weren't open for whatever reason, that's why I don't do buyouts. People all the time want to do buyouts to just like, let me, I'll buy the whole restaurant or the bar for the night for a party. I've never once done it because I built it for those people.
So I think you might have said those times though wrong. So what time do you open?
5 p.m.
And you close at what time?
3 a.m.
3 a.m. Okay, I think you said 3 p.m.
Oh, 3 a.m.
So, yeah, well, I think that's normal, right?
It's normal. Oh, it's normal, but there are a lot of, I mean, I've been to places that, oh, we didn't have enough people, so we closed at 1:30. There were only 3 people there, you know. So that's, I mean, the depth of my being a micromanager with my staff in the very beginning was, here's a couple things that will, you can work here. As long as you have to be here at 4 o'clock to set up. If you walk in at 4:01, you basically have sent me a resignation letter saying I don't choose to work at church. So you can't come after 4 o'clock and set up. If you ever do, you're saying I don't want to work at church. And I said the second thing is there are three things. The second thing is you can't park within eyesight of church because we have no parking. So you have to park somewhere else. You have to ride your bicycle. You have to park on the next street or whatever because it's for our customers. And the third thing is this is all about trust. If I ever catch you, if you ever lie or steal, there's not really any question because we're a team of people working for the same goal. So here we are.
Now, before the days of Uber, where were these people parking? Because that's tough. How'd they just figure out how to get there? Because you don't have any parking, I'm aware of that.
I was ahead of the curb, just like in ping pong. That's weird because somebody just said that to me yesterday. Or last night I was at church, and somebody said to me, who knew that Uber is going to come along, which is great for you because they drop off and Lyft drop off for church. And
it's great for staff, it's great for patrons, it's great for everybody.
Yeah, and when people come from out of town for conventions and stuff, they'll ask the concierge, Where do we go that we can't find in our town?
Right.
In Atlanta, right. Where do you go that you only see in Atlanta? And they basically say two places, church and Claremont Lounge.
Now,
titties and Jesus.
Now I would say, you were wanting me to say Claremont Lounge, uh-huh. which I would have, except I was thinking, for some reason I was thinking I was thinking of King of Pops because yeah. We just talked about them. But Blondie, by the way, is on my list of people to get for this show. Like when I was writing down my list, these are the people I want. Like so, I haven't made that happen yet, but I'd like to.
Well, take a big PBR can with you, an empty one, because she has tricks up her
sleeve. I'm well aware. I'm well aware. So I do have to ask you, because the only things about you on the internet are things where you've sort of gotten in trouble. So I do want to ask you about those. So we'll start with the Halloween parade thing. Do you know what I'm talking about? I love you. You're not even aware.
Hell no.
So apparently, you thought it would be funny, as did I, to have a white van. Do you know where I'm going with this yet? You're like looking at me like you have no idea what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. What do you call that page where people read about you?
Wikipedia.
My Wikipedia page, personal, and church Wikipedia page were hacked.
So it's not even true? None of it's true.
We did do the van, but you know how you can go on and change it or whatever?
Right.
And I've never been one to defend myself at all because I don't give a shit. You know, and we did that. No, it was awesome. It was the greatest thing. It was great. We did a van, white van, and we didn't start planning. We don't plan parades until 8 o'clock the morning of the parade.
Right.
And that's the policy. And you can't think about it or whatever. So somebody at coffee said, well, my neighbor has a white van or whatever. So we basically just put tape on the sides of vehicles, you know, because we don't really have much time to build things between 8 a.m. and, you know, the afternoon or whatever. So what did the van say? Hold on just a minute.
It was a play on words. It was really good.
Something to do with, wait just a minute, child.
Child traffic king.
Child, okay, so it didn't all fit. We missed, we were putting up child traffic. I was going to put child, because a friend of mine was doing a, she was doing a fundraiser. We had flyers for the fundraiser because she was doing a comedy thing about child trafficking, but it was to raise money against child trafficking.
Right.
So this was, so we had a, my friend Larry put a speaker on the front of it, and we were playing ice cream music.
Right.
So then four of us, I love, we all put on black trench coats.
Right.
With no pants underneath, just shorts.
Right.
And then black socks and black Sunday school shoes or whatever. So we were walking.
I'm having trouble with the connection. Please try.
We were having, so we were walking around passing out these flyers to go to my friend's comedy class.
Right.
Or the comedy show that was, I think the next Thursday or something or whatever. Right. So we have ice cream music going. And so on the side of it, it says child trafficking. And then on the back of it, it said, it's not funny.
Right.
Which was hilarious.
Well, but it also said child trafficking, like you were the child traffic king. That wasn't intentional. That was just, it didn't fit.
No, it didn't fit. It did not fit. See, I don't plan anything, okay? It just, I tried to put it on the same, but it didn't do it. It was hilarious. We realized that King would be.
It was, in fact, hilarious. So the other stuff, none of that's true about, what was the other thing? That you inflated the price of the, what you bought it for, what you sold it for. Do you have enemies that would do that to you?
I'd rather not say.
Okay.
I would say that I don't have enemies. There's one person that is not happy that, you know, Sister Louise's church and.
And you'd rather not even have someone on your staff go and fix it on the website. You just don't even care, the Wikipedia thing.
I don't really give a shit. I mean. It's, you know, all, I mean, keep talking. You know, that's like when I first opened up church, I was bartending, and somebody comes up to me, one of my servers comes up to me and says, hey, Grant, there's a priest and three nuns upstairs. They're taking pictures of everything, and they're not being really nice to the customers. So you want me to tell them to stop taking pictures? And I said, oh, no. What do you want me to tell him? I said, put it on the internet. And so then about 30 minutes later, this priest and three nuns, really a real priest and three nuns, came up and they, you know, did this to me. And I walked over and I said, they said, can we talk? And I said, actually, I'm bartending and I have to make all these drinks for all these people right now. He's going to ask you one question. And I said, yeah. And he said, can I get your permission to take pictures of your art? And I said to him, I said, well, actually, my server has said that you've been taking pictures, so I think I think you're here to ask for forgiveness, not permission.
Right.
And put it on the internet. You know, I don't really care. It's not me. Everything I have, it's not ever, you know, there's nothing malicious. There's nothing. I've never gotten in trouble about anything at it. There are, you know, everybody, again, anytime anybody says anything about church or what I do or what anybody does, it's their perception from their point of view. It has nothing to do, you know, as long as I stick to the truth and as long as I sort of follow the light that I see I need to go towards, then all this noise on every other side has nothing to do with me. And if I make it part of me, it becomes my life and I don't have time, you know.
What do you lose sleep over or pull your hair out over?
I'm a fucking idiot. That my faith is bigger than my brain. I like to create stuff. So I started church, and then I did Athens. And during the Athens build-out, I didn't sleep because I thought, what the fuck am I doing? You know, Steve and I went over there one night, and it was raining, and we'd go up and down the streets. I already got in the space. Go up and down the streets where all the bars are, and no one was there. And there'd be like six employees. So that whole night, I didn't sleep. And we got up the next morning, came back to Atlanta, and it's like, so I was like, I'm a fucking idiot. And so then I opened up the church merge. I'm a fucking idiot. Then I do, right now, I lose sleep because I bought this, you know, 38-acre Girl Scout camp down in Griffin, and it's 30 minutes below the airport. And now I'm just thinking, you know what? I could have retired. What am I doing? I could have retired. But my dreams and my passion for everything I've ever done is like transforming something that nobody wants to somebody. Because I've redone how I like to buy houses that nobody wants and, you know, make them nice, and then the neighborhood sort of change. I love that. And I love it happened at Edgewood here. I love it in Athens, the end of the street. There's bar after bar after bar after bar. Went out of business where I am now. And we're in business. Everybody else lasts, you know, not very long. Because it's like actually you instill passion and love and care into something, whether it's a building or people or whatever. So that's, I saw this Girl Scout camp down in Griffin. It had been abandoned for 4 years. I had been a counselor when I was a kid. So it was just like, all right, I bought this fucking Girl Scout camp, you know, when I could be sitting on the beach in Isla Mujeres, you know, with my feet up. But so now that's what I do. During the process, I just doubt every way. But when I get through with it and look back, I'm glad I did it. So I hope this is the same thing happens here in Griffin.
I think that's the perfect place to end, except we have to do the Atlanta podcast quiz, which is how we finish up the program. It's very exciting. Are you ready?
Okay.
Okay, hang on.
Am I supposed to be saying something to you?
No, it's fine. Okay, so I just want to kind of center us up here. All right, are you ready? This is a very exciting part of the quiz. Okay, I'm end of the show. Okay, right. What is your go-to Waffle House meal?
I've only been maybe twice in my life.
You're a walking contradiction, sir. I've never had anyone stumped by that first question.
Yeah.
Even if they don't go that often, they usually know.
I mean, I love the concept. I love their branding, but I love the fact that they have a lot of fucked up, you know, things that happen there, but I don't really go there. I'm not up at 3 a.m. Okay. I have to be there at 3 a.m. or something.
I mean, some people go there like for breakfast, like a regular breakfast. All right, what is your favorite place to eat in Atlanta?
I get stuck. Number one, I mostly only like to go to places that I know the owners.
Okay.
Just because I just, you know, like to support them or whatever. I would say the two places I float between the most are Eats on Ponce de Leon. He's the guy that was part owner of the local that got me that job. And then just because it's healthy food and I love it and I love seeing him and his employees that have been there a long time, and he's the world's greatest boss. Second place is Thumbs Up on Edgewood. It's over there by church, and I've been going there for years. Actually, the manager over there is Kevin Eek, and there was a Thumbs Up in Decatur when I was in seminary 40 years ago in the 80s, and she still works there. So I like that little thread of longevity and loyalty, you know. So but those two places, sometimes I have hot dogs at this bar called Church. I probably had 10 of them since we opened up. So Thumbs Up and Eats are my two favorites.
Okay.
And there are a lot of other places that are great and wonderful, and I have a lot of friends that own a lot of restaurants. But, Fellini's too.
Which one?
If I don't want to talk to people, I go to the one over on, or if I don't want to see people, over in Candle Park, but mostly Ponce. I do most of my staff meetings over there.
People don't know you in Candle Park? You can hide there?
Yeah. Well, you can go in the back and you can just sort of, it's good. You know, I like it. It's just when I just want to go get a slice of pizza.
Got it. Rank these in importance to you. Okay. Falcons, Braves, Hawks, United.
What shape is the ball?
Hawks play with the round one. Braves play with the small white one.
You know, I've heard a lot about... I've heard a lot about the United. I would like to go to a United game, but...
God doesn't
I'm
want you
sure
there?
If it's...
You just pointed it up.
Is it... I'm not sure if it's hockey or soccer. United
is the soccer.
Soccer.
Many of your patrons, I'm sure, love the
there's
soccer.
No. I would say United, Braves, Hawks,
Falcons.
Falcons.
Okay.
But I don't really, I'm not a sports guy. I'm just not a sports guy. Okay. I just don't know anything about sports. I don't understand it when humans get together and they get all passionate about, no, but this guy's this and you should have seen him and he's going to do this. And when he was with it, I don't understand. I don't know where their brain gets the capacity to find, you know, remember facts about that. And I know a lot of people who do these, like, I don't know what they call them, but it's like fake teams or they create little,
fantasy.
I don't understand it.
But you understand competition.
Not the sports wise. My older brother, who I tried to be the antithesis of, was a sports guy. So I just know, you know, I've never done that.
But when you even jokingly say, I'll kick your ass in the ping pong table, that's competition.
It's more about intimidation that make you think you're going to lose before I get there.
but that's a lot of sports. Sports is very mental that way.
Well, for me, that's only with ping pong, I guess, because I don't do it with pool, billiards. I don't do it with anything else but ping pong. And I used to really could kick anybody's ass. Right now, anybody would kick my ass. Really? Don't tell anybody, though.
Because you don't want it to be said that the guy that owns church is bad at ping pong or not as good as he used to be.
Oh, I don't care. I don't really care, but, I mean, I just don't play anymore, you know? I lost my good ping pong paddle. It made me sad, so I thought, fuck this shit. I'm not doing this.
That's a good way to look at life, I think. Just lose the paddle, fuck it all. Okay, complete the sentence. I take Marta blank.
I take Marta to the airport occasionally.
Okay. Common answer. Except for your friend... Nick, who takes it all the time, apparently. He's a Marta guy. What's your favorite festival in Atlanta?